Google is involved in another incident with China. The company reported yesterday that hundreds of its Gmail accounts have been compromised by hackers based in China. Google said the attack targeted senior government officials and military personnel from the United States and other countries, also Chinese political activists and journalists. The hackers are said to have stolen passwords and monitored email traffic. The Chinese government is vigorously denying responsibility for the latest intrusion into the Google network, but Secretary of State Hillary Clinton today said the United States is very concerned about the attack.
Google informed the State Department of this situation yesterday in advance of its public announcement. These allegations are very serious. We take them seriously. We're looking into them.
Well, joining us now is NPR's Tom Gelton. And Tom, what could be going on here? What would somebody in China do with these stolen passwords, say?
Well, Robert, if you had passwords for these Gmail accounts, obviously you could go in and you could read those emails. You could also pose as that person and send out emails from that account, which would then lead you to other information. And even more important, what you could do is go in and change your email settings so that all future emails coming in might be automatically forwarded to some third email account. So you would really have ongoing access to this email traffic.
Well, from what we know, how did this hacking of Google accounts from China take place?
It seems to be, Robert, a case of phishing. And we've all heard about phishing attacks where you get emails that tempt you or are meant to tempt you to click on them, and then you inadvertently provide personal information, including your passwords. For example, there was one email that came from a State Department address, and it referred to a joint statement that was coming out in draft form, and this would be government officials. You would click on it to read the statement, and you would obviously want to read what was being said, and then in the process, you would reveal your password.
This is an example of phishing spelled with a PH.
Phishing with a PH, right.
You mentioned a State Department official, and Google says that some of these hacked email accounts belonged to senior U.S. government officials. Does that mean that any sensitive government information was actually disclosed or taken here?
Well, Robert, these were private email accounts. These are Gmail accounts. They're not government official email accounts. And so far, the Pentagon, for example, is saying it does not know of any sensitive information that was disclosed. However, you know, some people have the habit of forwarding their official emails to their personal email accounts or vice versa. So you can't be for sure that no sensitive information was disclosed.
Now, we've often heard about hackers going into private email accounts to get credit card information or to get access to money. But Google here suggests this was more than just a case of individual hackers. There is the suspicion, at least, that the Chinese government may have been involved.
Right. Google says this attack came from Jinan, China. Now, that is the same city in China where Google said its earlier attack last year came from. And the interesting thing here, Robert, is that there is a high-tech military training school in Jinan where the Chinese army's cyber warriors are said to be trained. So hence the suspicion.
So is the suspicion that this could have been a practice exercise for people who would later on be doing something more serious? Or what else would be the purpose of something like this?
Well, possibly the purpose here was what cybersecurity experts call social engineering. They're trying to find out information about individual people in order to identify those people whose, let's say, their defenses might be not as great as someone else's. And then those people would be used in a future attack against perhaps another government agency, another company. So this could have been just the first phase of what would be a much larger, more ambitious attack down the road.
Secretary Clinton said the government is looking into these allegations. What's likely to happen next?
Well, she said that the FBI is looking into them. In addition, one of the things that's important to keep in mind here is that the United States is pushing for more international cooperation, more collaboration to stop this kind of thing. This could put pressure on the Chinese government to be more cooperative than it has been in the past, if it really, as it says, wants to stop these attacks.
Thank you, Tom.
You're so welcome.
It's NPR National Security Correspondent Tom Gelton.
More coming up from All Things Considered. Now we want to go a little deeper on news that broke earlier this week that the World Health Organization has added cell phones to its long list of possible causes of cancer. Now, cell phones are so much a part of people's lives that we just had to ask NPR's Eliza Barkley to talk to us about what she wrote regarding the WHO conclusions. She wrote about this for NPR's health blog called Shots. She's a web producer on NPR's Science Desk, and she's with us now in our Washington, D.C. studio. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, obviously, this is a cause of great concern to people. It's very attention-getting. Cell phones, I mean, are ubiquitous these days. In fact, many people use a cell phone who don't even have a landline anymore. So you can see why people are very concerned about this. So just briefly, as you can, tell us, what's the recommendation?
Well, what the WHO is saying is that based on some very limited scientific evidence that they have, there may be some cause for concern that cell phones could cause cancer, but they don't really know.
What is the reason behind this concern?
They've looked at a couple of recent studies, and while none of these studies actually proved that cell phones cause cancer, there were a couple of groups, and in particular, these are people who are long-term heavy users of cell phones, people who talk on their phone 30 minutes a day for more than 10 years. Within that particular group, there was some increased risk for certain kinds of brain tumors specifically.
What exactly was the data that they looked at?
Well, what they did was they talked to people who had brain tumors, and then they asked them about their cell phone use. But the thing is, with this kind of research, it's very hard to prove that it was the cell phones in people's lives that had actually caused the cancer, right? There are so many environmental factors that can contribute to cancer. And a lot of scientists said that these studies were, in fact, flawed and inconclusive, because how can you really know that it was the cell phone?
I mean, I think everybody knows that the use of cell phones has increased exponentially, you know, worldwide in recent years. Has the incidence of brain cancer also increased?
No, it hasn't really. And so that should be a pretty clear indication that it's hard to draw a strong correlation between cell phones and brain cancer.
What would be the possible link?
Well, cell phones emit a kind of radiation. It's a low-level type of radiation. But the thing is, this radiation is not the kind of radiation that damages DNA and causes mutations that can lead to cancer. It's not the same as radiation, for example, from X-rays. It's closer to radiation from microwaves.
If the data on this is as ambiguous as it seems to be, or as incomplete or as inconclusive, why would the WHO issue this pronouncement now?
Well, they really want more research on this topic. And fortunately, there are a couple of big studies underway right now in the United States and Europe that could help them get to the bottom of this. Remember, this is a really hard thing to study. People haven't been using cell phones for that long. And health researchers like to have a lot of data, years and years, decades if they can get it, before they are really confident about a health trend. Just think about how long it took them to prove that smoking causes cancer.
Is there a specific recommendation that flows from this, even if this information is inconclusive?
Well, you could use your wireless or wired headset, because the cell phone's antenna, that way it wouldn't be next to your head. It would be somewhere else in the body. So that's one possible thing to do. But in general, you know, a lot of researchers are not that concerned about this. And the other thing is that there are billions of people today using cell phones, and they really haven't seen an increase in the type of brain tumor that they're concerned about anywhere.
So what would be the point of announcing this now if the information is as ambiguous as it seems to be?
Well, they want to be cautious. They're saying, we don't yet know enough about this, but we should take a precaution anyway, and we'll consider this as a possible carcinogen, possible being the key word.
So I'm going to put you on the spot. You still using your cell phone? Are you going for your hands-free listening device? I don't want to use a trade name here. Are you biasing toward your hands-free listening device?
Well, it's definitely made me think about it a little bit more, but I'm still using my cell phone just as much as everybody. It's pretty hard to even cut down.
Eliza Barkley is a web producer for NPR's Science Desk. She writes for NPR's health blog called Shots. And if you want to read the piece that she wrote about this issue, we'll link to it on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More. Eliza, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Once upon a time, there was an intimate gathering of people. They were friends. They chatted, shared pictures of parties, talked about music, the movies they liked, sent updates to one another, and what they ate for lunch. But then two more friends joined, and they told two other friends to join, and soon there were hundreds of friends and friends of friends and grandmothers of friends. And then the companies they thought and things they bought with. They wanted to know what the friends wanted. They wanted things from these friends. And the whole idea of what it meant to be friends became confusing. Some of the friends wanted to leave, to unfriend, to go to a less crowded group of friends, one that really knew them and respected their privacy. Sound like your situation? Too many friends on your social network? Too many people or advertisers vying for your attention? Is there some other place to go? Does the perfect social network exist? Well, maybe not, but concerned people are working on it, and my next guest covers some of the up-and-coming social network sites in a new article she has written for her column, All Things Digital. Liz Gaines is a senior editor at All Things Digital, and she joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Welcome back to Science Friday, Liz.
Thank you.
You're right that while Facebook might be the hottest game in town, it's still a pretty warped and inaccurate picture of what it means to have friends. What do you mean by that?
I mean just what you're talking about. As your friends have exploded beyond maybe the people you went to college with or the people you hang out with on weekends to include your employer and your grandmother and all these other different parts of your life, maybe what you're saying becomes a little bit diluted, and you really don't want to say the same thing to all those people. So you stop using Facebook, the biggest social network that 700 million people actively use every month, and you maybe retreat into yourself or go back offline.
So you're saying that when people say that they don't like Facebook because of the privacy, that's really not the issue.
I do think that is one of the big issues, and certainly the one most actively portrayed in the media. I think that there are maybe five or so key weaknesses of Facebook, including the kind of awkward friending model and that it creates these static friendships that don't really expire like natural friendships do, and privacy issues, as well as other potential areas of improvement that maybe other people could do better that might have more a social network that has a closer relationship to where we are in time instead of just our real name as we express ourselves online might be a better representation of ourselves. So what I was doing was looking at some of the weaknesses of Facebook and looking at some promising new social networking sites that address them better.
Let's talk about some of those. What have you found?
Well, one of the things that I think is most interesting is talking about friends in a more dynamic way. So, for instance, if you were to go to a wedding this weekend, many people there would be taking pictures with their smartphones. And every picture that's taken with a smartphone is geotagged. We know when and where it was taken. And if we were to all join a social network together, for instance, there's one called Color. There's one called Like a Little. There are quite a few of these sites. More apps because you have them on your smartphone. And we all took these pictures at the same time. These services would recognize that we were all there and create this kind of collaborative album that tells a story told by many people who are in the same place at the same time. And I think we all might appreciate that version of it rather than looking all over Facebook or just our own albums to see what happened.
And until I read your column, I didn't even know these existed.
Well, the thing is, they're quite small. these are new and emerging services. I wouldn't say that they're anywhere near taking on Facebook for our mindshare. And it's really hard to start a new social network because the point of being on one of these sites or using one of these apps is because your friends are there. Mm-hmm. And achieving those kind of network effects does not come easily.
1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to suggest what you'd like to see in your friendship. Or what kind of social networking you would like. Give us a call. You can also tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI or go to our Facebook page at /SciFry. What happened to Diaspora? We talked about that last year. It was supposed to be sort of an open source version of Facebook.
Diaspora is still in the works. I think those guys put up a blog post recently saying it's still coming, but it's only in private beta, meaning it's not even available to everyone who wants to use it. There's another site that's called Altly, A-L-T-L-Y, that just announced itself, I think maybe a week or two ago, saying that they're going to provide a more privacy-conscious alternative to Facebook. And honestly, when I put up this story earlier this week, my comments were filled with more and more people talking about these sites. But the reality is starting a privacy-conscious version of Facebook means that your users are going to make their information private by default, which means no one's going to be able to find them.
starting a distributed version of Facebook where your users host their own information rather than putting it on a network where someone else owns it means that your users have to be pretty geeky. So these things are hard to start.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the big problems with Facebook is you can't really separate your personal life from your work life like you can on something like LinkedIn.
That's right. But LinkedIn, I think, at least for me, and is a site where I go to get information but not necessarily to engage and hang out. It's very useful for what it is, but I wouldn't say LinkedIn is even a social network.
Oh, you don't think it is?
I don't. I mean, I think that a social network addresses is an online alternative to the way that we engage and interact with our friends offline. I know that the expression of who our friends are is a pretty wide thing, and many people are friends with their coworkers. But I think LinkedIn is oriented much more towards people who are seeking jobs or seeking to hire people. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about Google on social networking. This 800-pound gorilla never really figured it out, did they?
It's true. And the CEO, or the former CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, longtime CEO for the last 10 years who just stepped down, he spoke at a conference put on by my company this week, and he was saying that He said about 4 years ago in internal memos that the issue of identity and figuring out a way to express who people are and disambiguate them online was a really core issue. And he sent around memos to that effect about 4 years ago, which really was when Facebook was just starting. It was much smaller than it is today. And he called it a screw up on his part that Google had not figured that out. And I think him saying identity is really him akin to him saying social, because Facebook has become the proxy for our identities online.
So there's no real competition to it, not even from Google, or in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it's kind of disappointing, I think.
Mm. I mean, it goes. You said there were 700 million people, but it seems like though the people have a love-hate relationship with it. Either love it and they use it, or I remember when we have tweets, you know, 120,000 plus Twitter members, and if I say something on Twitter saying go to our Facebook page and check it out, they get insulted.
Is that right? They prefer to interact with you in that environment.
They say yes. We tweet. We don't do Facebook. And if they did Facebook, they would have to do it exactly the way that the founder didn't like, and that is to phony up a page. They'd have to go on as a pseudonym.
And well, I think that's great that they're thinking about their options. But what I do see is when I see these new sites start, they build on top of Facebook because Facebook offers some tools called Facebook Connect. And Twitter actually offers something similar as well, but the Facebook one is much more widely used, where when you sign on to a new site, you can also plug into your account on Facebook and bring all your friends on Facebook. And when you post new information on this site, it gets fed back to your Facebook newsfeed, so it attracts more people to come in. And it's really hard for new sites to kind of let go of that. It's addicting to use Facebook Connect because it makes their services so much more instantly populated with people's friends.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get a quick call in here. Let's go to Michael in, is it Decorah, Iowa?
Decorah, but close enough.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. On Facebook, I'm a member of the younger generation. I still don't like the fact I was told that when you click the like button, say for a certain company, it can then follow who your friends are, what your personal information is, and use it to try and data mine for their own personal profit. And I, for one, don't like that. I know a lot of members of my generation don't mind, but I don't like that. So that would be a suggestion for a social network.
Can I ask what generation you are?
Well, I'm 14, so I'm not sure how to classify it, but I'm still pretty young. I'm going into high school this year. So.
All right, that's close enough. Thank you, Michael.
Yep, bye.
How long have you been on Facebook?
I got rid of him.
Lost him?
thought he was done.
I just thought it was an interesting side note is that the Consumer Reports recently estimated that there are 7.5 million kids under 13 on Facebook who are lying about their age to be on there, which was potentially interesting. That's right, because they're not allowed on Facebook at that age because there are some pretty clear restrictions about how their parents have to let them on the site.
So you have to be 18 and under or over? 18 and
13.
Over? 13.
13 to 18, you get very special restrictions on your account, and then 18 and above is all one big group.
Mm-hmm. I guess that is what people don't like. They don't want their information to be used to go to these different companies to sell you stuff or to follow you around.
Yeah, and Facebook is built to be maximally viral, but not maximally private, which is how they've grown so quickly. But when you disagree with something that Facebook is doing with your information, you really have to go deep into those privacy settings to change it.
What feature would you like, in the minute I have left, to see on Facebook or any social network, and what feature would you like to get rid of?
I think that really this issue of friending is really broken. I think that I would... Now my group of friends on Facebook, I think I have about 1,000, and I don't accept every friend request that I see, is such an odd representation of what my life has been. You see someone at a high school reunion and you immediately become friends. You meet someone and hang out for a dinner at a conference professionally, and immediately you become friends. And then maybe a year later, you're looking at those names in your newsfeed and you don't really remember even who those people are. Mm-hmm. But I think there's still a lot of stigma around breaking that relationship and unfriending those people. And I'd like maybe a little bit of a more nuanced representation.
And are there any of these up-and-coming sites that have that you have talked about or might recommend trying out?
Absolutely. I think there are different. There's one called Path, which limits users to sharing to only 50 friends. And then there are some of these other ones called Color and Like a Little, which are more represented by the people that you're actually in proximity with, which I think is a nice way to approximate who you care about. And then there are some like Google's Android, which I think actually could be a potential competitor to Facebook, that really know much better who is in your phone book because they have access to your mobile phone.
Well, thanks for that advice, Liz.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on. Liz Gaines is senior editor at All Things Digital, and you can check out her articles at allthingsd.com. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to stay with computers a little bit, but we're going to talk about computer sabotage and the idea that the U.S. government now considers that sabotage may be an act of war. But can you do anything about it? And how vulnerable are we? We'll talk about all of that. Stay with us.
Today, Apple's CEO Steve Jobs will speak to thousands of Apple software developers who've gathered in San Francisco for an annual conference. Jobs is expected to offer details on a new online music storage system and the latest operating system, among other positives. What he may not talk about is a recent attack on Mac computers. Up until now, Apple products have been blissfully free of computer attacks, but that era may be ending. We called Bloomberg technology analyst Rich Jaroslawski to find out more, and thank you for joining us again.
Thank you.
Tell us about this attack. What form did it take?
Well, this is a category known as malware, and in this case, what happens is that when you visit an infected website, the site installs a program on your computer that opens a window with a scary-sounding message that tells you that your computer is infected and that you need software to eradicate the infection and to please give your credit card number. So what it is a category known broadly as phishing, and what they're really after is your credit card information, which they can then put to various nefarious purposes.
And, of course, people are savvy often and don't give out their credit cards, but just enough of them give them out for this to work.
Exactly. And what's interesting about this is that up until now, this has been a fairly common sort of thing in the Windows world. And after all, most computers in the world are still Windows. But as the Mac has grown, particularly in the consumer market, individual consumers don't have corporate IT departments to warn them, don't do this. And so just enough of them are doing it so that it's become a real problem. And in some ways, it's almost a rite of passage for the Mac, because it says that it's now mainstream enough so that the bad guys are targeting it.
And the bad guys, at this point, do we know who they might be?
We really don't know much about who they might be, at least if security experts do, they're not yet telling us. These programs open up with names like Mac Defender. There's a variant called Mac Protector. And, of course, the names themselves are deeply ironic because the last thing that they want to do is protect you.
And what does this mean for Apple mobile devices, the iPhone?
The kernel of the Mac operating system, the sort of core of it, is also found in Apple mobile devices. And so a successful attack on the Mac theoretically could become something that could also affect mobile devices. Now, because Apple runs its App Store so tightly, and you really can't download anything onto the mobile device that hasn't gone through Apple's approval process, there's a certain built-in extra layer of protection there. But it does point up, and if nothing else, it's highly symbolic of the fact that nothing is safe.
And, of course, in that whole world that you're just speaking of, it's iPad, iPod Touch. I mean, it's not even just that. I mean, that's a big universe, isn't it, at this point?
It's a very big universe of iDevices. I think right now Apple still has something like 90% of the tablet market, and, of course, it's growing very, very rapidly. But in addition, it also points up the fact that you've got this additional large universe of Android devices, which don't even have the level of protection, perhaps, that the Apple products do. So it should be a wake-up call to consumers to be extra vigilant, not only with their Windows computers, which they already know have issues, but essentially with any device that they use that connects to the Internet.
Rich Jaroslawski is the technology columnist for Bloomberg News. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Steve Jobs is expected to return from medical leave to announce a new music service at Apple's annual developers conference on Monday. The service, called iCloud, is rumored to have been in the works for the last year. All indications are that for the first time, the major record labels and music publishers have gotten behind a service that will let people tap into their entire iTunes collection from almost any Internet-connected device. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
People are getting more comfortable with storing and accessing content on the Internet, from photos to movies, says Forrester analyst Charles Golvin.
This idea that my content doesn't have to be sitting on my hard drive or on my iPhone or on my other device for me to be able to access it, as long as I have a network connection, I should be able to get to it.
On Monday, Apple will be the third big company to introduce a service that will let you access your music from the so-called cloud. Google and Amazon have introduced cloud music services, but they've been a bit slow, says Golvin.
With the Google Music service, it starts scanning your library and uploading songs in the background. And, of course, some of those will be available to you depending on which ones have started the upload.
And when you buy new music, you'll again have to go through the process of uploading before it's accessible. There's a reason for that. Google and Amazon launched their services without agreements with the major record labels and music publishers. Jeff Price is the CEO of the digital music company TuneCore.
There are certain laws and procedures that have to be followed, and if they're not, it opens up anybody to huge amounts of legal liability where they could be sued out of existence.
Take a big hit, like.
And I will always love you.
The song was written by Dolly Parton and sung by Whitney Houston for Columbia Records.
You have a recording that actually has two copyrights to it. One for the recording of the song, and that's owned by Columbia Records, and the other for the song itself, and that's owned by Dolly Parton.
In the terrestrial radio world, every time the song gets played, both Dolly Parton and Columbia get paid. Rights holders have been applying the same copyright laws to the online world. So every time a streaming service like Pandora plays I Will Always Love You, it pays royalties for the right to stream that song from its servers to your computer or mobile device. So without royalty agreements, Amazon and Google can't stream anything. Instead, they're in essence maintaining a hard drive for you in the cloud where you access the music you've put there. By all accounts, Apple's service will work differently. Say you want to hear Adele's Someone Like You. iCloud scans your iTunes collection, matches the ID for the song there with its iTunes ID, and streams the song from Apple's locker.
Never mind. You, I wish nothing but the best of you too.
Though other companies tried to reach agreements with the labels and publishers, Apple is reportedly the first company to make a deal with all four majors. Forrester analyst Charles Golvin thinks that's because labels have already made money from Apple's iTunes Store and Apple has the most popular music software.
And the fact that so many people have so much content invested in their iTunes libraries today that adding a service that they can monetize in some way, then they see a revenue opportunity there that they may not see from someone like Google.
In other words, the music industry went with the devil it knows, even though the record companies have long complained about Apple's dominance of online music. Right now, there's a lot of unconfirmed speculation about what iCloud will offer. But Gartner analyst Mike McGuire thinks it will have to offer extras to consumers to entice them to pay for the service, like being able to play an entire song or maybe even an album at least once before you buy it.
What extends this and makes it potentially more attractive to consumers is if they have that ability to do more sampling of full-length albums or songs or things like that.
Apple's cloud service may also present the first opportunity for record labels and songwriters to collect money from unauthorized copies of songs. Because of the way iCloud works, when it matches a song ID in your collection with the ID in the iTunes database, rights holders will get paid, most likely out of a fee Apple will charge users for the iCloud service.
And it's just based on what's in the user's library, not necessarily where they came from. You know, there may be some positive in that. If there's a substantial amount of that content that came from a P2P source, then there may be a little recoupment, if you will, of some of those files that were distributed via P2P software.
Because Apple has had such success with so many of its music products, there is a lot of anticipation about iCloud. But as McGuire and others point out, Apple has had its failures. It already has a cloud service for photos and other content called Mobile Me, and that's been a flop. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
You know, sometimes you just want to order in. You don't want to have to explain that order again and again to the person on the other end of the phone who's taking three or more orders at the same time. Well, rest assured, more and more businesses feel your pain. As Emma Jacobs reports, restaurants are trying to make the ordering process easier by letting customers do everything online.
Last year, Jeremiah Carpenter decided his Papa John's franchise in upstate New York wasn't doing enough business for the Super Bowl, so he started a special offer. Any large pizza for $10 on game day. This year, he says Papa John's ran the special nationally.
I don't want to say they copied me, but they copied me, okay?
Carpenter's been in a pitched creative battle for customers with other local pizza chains.
We're kind of in the middle of what we call the pizza wars. Like, everyone's fighting, you know? Everyone's doing this, who's given the best value.
But Carpenter thinks he's pulling ahead, maybe in part because customers can click on his local specials right on Papa John's website. Customers can place their order online, and the orders go straight to monitors in Carpenter's kitchen.
It lets the customer see what they want, get what they want. They get a more consistent experience. We can focus more on making the pies, getting it out the door, taking care of that stuff for the customers.
One of those patrons, Krista Kermitis, stops in for pickup. She made her order earlier in the day from her smartphone.
When I'm on the go and I try and cram a whole bunch of things in and I'm a single mom, and so if the app is right there on my phone and I can just go to it and put it in and I don't have to worry about, well, shoot, what the heck was that phone number?
About a third of Carpenter's customers now order from the web. He's an enthusiastic early adopter. He's actually working on a program to run the whole store from his iPad. But a growing number of restaurateurs seem to be catching up with Carpenter's enthusiasm for technology. Sherry Kimes is a professor at Cornell School of Hotel Administration. Her latest study shows a quarter of chain restaurants and more than half of pizza and sandwich shops now take online orders.
Kind of makes you look at it and go, wow, I mean, this is a lot more than what I thought was going on.
About half of customers have ordered food online. Kimes says doing online ordering well and early has helped chains like Papa John's pull in more patrons.
Most restaurants in the U.S. are aware of this now, and it's just a matter of trying to figure out, okay, how can we best do this? Because there are some operational and cost issues associated with it as well.
Restaurants aren't just setting up their own systems. They're also joining multi-restaurant sites like Snapfinger and Grubhub that let any restaurant upload its menu. While most of Carpenter's orders come from Papa John's website, another set comes from a site called campusfood.com, which is targeting college towns.
You don't want to have, 50 different logins for your 50 different restaurants.
Mike Saunders is the founder of Campus Food. It's one of a slew of sites competing to be the online middleman for takeout.
Why would I go to PapaJohns.com or Domino's.com? Ultimately, there needs to be the Amazon of food.
Saunders says multi-restaurant sites also offer more to a huge part of the market, smaller chains and restaurants that can't afford to set up their own secure ordering site. Researcher Sherry Kimes agrees online ordering will grow, but she expects the final frontier may be on Facebook. Nearly all the restaurants she looked at were on Facebook. Only a handful took orders through the site.
For NPR News, I'm Emma Jacobs.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic online backup to keep photos, music, and other files safe from computer mishaps. Details at carbonite.com.
This is NPR.